Okay, here we go. The training world is full of technical editing courses that don't teach you the high-end creativity that viewers expect. Inside the Edit was created specifically to teach you every single creative skill you'll ever need to mesmerize your audience. Hey everybody, it's great to be back for episode 16 of Once Upon a Timeline, the official podcast of Inside the Edit. Thank you for joining me, Paddy Bird, for another stacked episode where we talk about just one thing: creative editing. Yep, this is not the place to discuss the latest updates to any editing software or what codec we should be using for any particular workflow. No, this is a place for editing artists who want to talk about the craft of editing, the psychology of editing, and all of the philosophical aspects of this beautiful art form of ours. I can't believe it, but it's been just 4 short months since this podcast's inception. You know, we've built a thriving community of editors in over 100 countries around the world. For me, that is nothing short of astonishing. I know we're going to get bigger and bigger, and it's all thanks to you for joining this creative editing movement and spreading the word. Thank you so much for being as dedicated and passionate about our art form as I am. So, what have we got in store on this week's show? Well, today we're going to look at our craft in a really interesting way. We're going to study some of the more existential yearnings we all have and the career possibilities that are now open to us. What's really interesting is that a huge advancement in technology, changes in economic structures, and a kind of new attitude to creativity has created, or at least allowed, the creation of an editing lifestyle that really wasn't possible when I started out. The ability for us to control our destiny and choose a creative life that is not only deeply fulfilling, but also completely independent, really is at our fingertips. We just have to know how to build it. And so, just like what's happened in careers like digital marketing and design, the life of the editing nomad is now possible and serves as this week's creative discussion. I also think it's a really timely subject with everything that's going on in the world right now. But before that, I am hugely excited to tell you that our bootcamp page at insidetheedit.com is now live. So go and take a look and register your interest for this brand new learning experience. It's going to be absolutely amazing. I'll talk a bit more about it after this week's creative discussion, so do stay tuned. We've also got a brand new competition this week. One lucky listener is going to win an annual license to Creative Cloud, courtesy of our good friends over at Adobe. So make sure you listen out for that later on in the show. Okay, let's get started with this week's creative discussion. Nearly 20 years ago, just after the millennium, I wrote and directed a short comedy drama that would do the rounds at the film festivals. I took the advice of various friends of mine in the industry who told me not to edit my own film and to get an editor to cut it. And so a close friend of mine who was an editor I admired suggested that we do something a little bit different. A new piece of editing software had just come out called Final Cut Pro. And my friend was adamant that we could put it on his laptop and edit somewhere outside of the, you know, the cramped and expensive edit facilities of central London. The kind of ones we were used to. He was convinced that we could dispense with all the kind of traditional setup of an edit suite and cut the film while sitting on the beach sipping cocktails all day. I mean, it sounded like a dream, but he did sell it to me well, and I really was hooked. So, one fine spring morning, we caught a flight to the Balearic Islands, just off the coast of Spain, hired some motorbikes, and went on the hunt for the most beautiful beach we could use as the backdrop for our edit suite. Yes, we romanticized the whole process completely, but if it worked, we saw this as a whole new way to edit. You know, a revolution was in the air, and we wanted to be riding the wave when it happened. The idea of having an edit suite on a laptop back then and not the massive hardware needed for an Avid was, you know, it was a complete novelty. My friend was editing a lot of MTV shows at the time and was convinced that he could persuade producers to fly over on cheap flights and edit in the sun. My short film would be the testing ground. So, did it work? Well, sort of. With around 15 to 20 crashes per day on the laptop and losing quite a bit of work, as well as the glare from the sun on the screen not allowing us to see the footage, the only thing that really worked smoothly and seamlessly was the cocktails we were drinking on the beach. Running out of money, cocktails are expensive, we opted to hire a cheap hotel room to finish the edit next to the beach. We spent the rest of the trip drinking cheap beer and sitting on the floor of the damp hotel room gathered around the tiny laptop. The revolution hadn't quite happened, but we finished the film and delivered it to the film festival and returned quietly with our tail between our legs to the edit suites of Soho in London. My friend turned to me at the end and said, "It'll all be different in a few more years." Skip forward 19 years, and it seems that he was right. There are so many reasons I've loved editing for the most part of my adult life, really. The creativity is deeply fulfilling, the variation is really exciting, and working with really talented directors and producers has always been a real privilege. Of course, like any editor, I've worked with my share of untalented nutcases as well. But there's always been another factor that featured very strongly for me, the lifestyle. Being a freelance editor has enabled me to be the master of my destiny and kind of pick and choose the projects that I've worked on. There's a deep existential need for freedom within the human subconscious, if you believe certain philosophers and psychologists of the last few hundred years. The thought of spending the 40 or 50 years of my adult working life going to the same office and doing the same thing every day always filled me with dread. I needed a creative life. So very early on, I decided that the life of an editing nomad, someone who works on lots of different films and in lots of different places and with lots of different people, was definitely the life for me. I chose the unstable and unpredictable life of a freelancer in the late 90s as a young man. And to be honest, I haven't looked back since. The freelance life has all the risk stacked into the first 5 or so years, and it can kind of be broken down into 2 distinct stages. At the start of the first stage, you are completely on your own and can only really rely on yourself and your own wits to get you work. It means teaching yourself the craft, working very long hours on any job you can get your hands on, and for many, myself included, sleeping on people's couches when you don't have enough money for rent that month. It can be unpredictable and stressful in those first few years, as it takes time to build up a roster of clients who know and like your work and can provide a consistent stream of income. Nowhere else are we more attuned to pleasing and charming our clients than in the freelance world, as next month's food bills rely on it. But if and when that first stage happens, and we sit back and realize that we have actually carved a career from nothing and built a group of directors, producers, and production companies that want to work with us, the feeling really is amazing. However, it's this next, second stage that will set the tone for the rest of our working life. This second stage, if crafted intelligently, is about attaining such an overabundance of work that we actually have clients fighting over us. And the benefits to this are huge. We get to pick and choose the most interesting projects to work on. We get to climb the ladder in terms of prestige. And above all, we get to choose the best paid work out there. The only gaps we have in our schedule are the ones we've chosen to take time off. You know, this is the dream. We don't have to go out and look for work. Work looks for us. So, is this easy to do? Definitely not. But is it possible? Absolutely. Sure, it requires an enormous amount of focus and effort. You know, we have to work on a lot of very unprestigious projects along the way. And we also have to get used to the unnerving feeling that we don't know if we're going to be working next month. But all that aside, there have been some revolutionary things that have been happening in our industry, in technology, and from an economic standpoint that have made the life of an editing nomad way more possible than when I entered the industry, you know, a quarter of a century ago. There's three really interesting factors that are worth talking about. So let's go through them. Firstly, the technology. I mean, it's truly amazing. No matter which piece of software you use, the fact that you can now edit, mix, or grade anything from a feature film to a commercial, you know, on a standard laptop is absolutely astonishing. I was part of the first generation of digital editors back in the mid-90s who started on Avid. You know, back then, an Avid was $100,000 and required some pretty serious hardware. The generation before me, though, they were on film and tape, and so it was even more amazing for them to go through that transition to where we are today. You know, you can edit using an app on a smartphone. It's just unbelievable. I've sat in coffee shops, art galleries, and museums and written and edited promos, documentaries, dramas, and even tutorials for Inside the Edit with just a decent pair of noise-cancelling headphones. That is true freedom, being completely independent from anyone and having the career, the clients, and the lifestyle to be a creative person who chooses how they live. And it's an amazing position to be in, which is now becoming so popular. The second interesting factor is content. The sheer amount of content in the world, you know, that needs to be edited on a daily basis is absolutely staggering. When I started, the internet was barely up and running, and we had 5 TV channels plus cable. Now we have thousands of channels and streaming services like Netflix and Amazon Prime, to name just a few. What is truly staggering is that all the content platforms like YouTube and Vimeo, which essentially allow brands or, you know, anyone really, any individual to create their own TV channel. But What they're used for is the real mind-boggling factor. Everything is digital nowadays. There are tens of millions of websites around the world, from everything from major brands to mom-and-pop stores. And here's the thing, they all require video. That is the number one thing anyone teaches you when you start a website. If you haven't got video on your site, then you're kind of dead in the water. Of course, all of these promo videos and lifestyle brands and, you know, all the other kinds of films, you know, they all need to be shot and edited. And so we really have a kind of global community of millions of customers for us as editors, which is absolutely unprecedented. A career in editing has literally never been easier. Now, does this mean that we're going to go walking straight into the Netflix offices and ask for a job on the next big budget drama series they're making without, you know, any prior experience? No, we have to start off at the bottom and work our way up. But that first rung of the ladder has never been easier. When I started, I offered to edit actors' showreels for a bottle of wine and a pizza. I edited anything from backdrop visuals for bands and techno raves to charities who couldn't afford, you know, even a tenth of high-cost production values. I made loads and loads of cheap promo videos for them. And I did this all for either a tiny bit of money or none at all, just to get my skills up, my CV growing, but also to build my self-identity as an editor. I spent several years doing freebies and low-paid editing by borrowing edit suites in many of London's prestigious edit facilities when friends were working overnight as runners. Yeah, I was broke, but I knew I wouldn't be broke forever. And to be honest with you, I actually just loved it. Being around editing, it was like one big love affair. Today, anyone can get clients to build their CV, even if it's poorly paid or a freebie. Within just a few months, we can get a showreel together by doing, you know, a free promo for a gardening center or a local supermarket or any one of a million shops or websites. Who's going to turn down a free video? And we can use these as a stepping stone to add to our showreel, and gradually the paid work will come. And then the good work will come. And then the really good work will come. Yeah, of course it takes time. But man, there's never been a better time to have clients. The third and final factor leads on from the previous two, and that is the global talent pool. You know, the enormous changes that have been happening in our economy over the last decade, they've made the life of a highly talented editing nomad really advantageous. If we want that creative freedom to pick and choose our clients, to work from anywhere in the world, and to work on high quality content, we have to be at the very top of our game. But these macroeconomic factors really help us out once we are highly skilled. I've mentioned it before in a previous episode, but I strongly advise you to go out and read Cal Newport's book, Deep Work. We're not affiliated with him in any way and have no contact or make no money out of mentioning it on the show. We just love this book, and it's 100% worth a buy. I just want to quote from what Cal says about this concept called the superstar effect, which is really interesting. In the book, he uses computer programmers as an example, but it's just as applicable for us editors. He begins, "High-speed data networks and collaboration tools like email and virtual meeting software have destroyed regionalism in many sectors of knowledge work. It no longer makes sense, for example, to hire a full-time programmer, put aside office space and pay benefits when you can instead pay one of the world's best programmers for just enough time to complete the project at hand. In this scenario, you'll probably get a better result for less money, while the programmer can service many more clients per year and will therefore also end up better off. The fact that they might be working from Marbella, Spain, while your office is in Des Moines, Iowa, doesn't matter for your company, as advances in communication and collaboration technology make the process near seamless. This reality does matter, however, to the less skilled local programmers living in Des Moines and in need of a steady paycheck. This same trend holds for the growing number of fields where technology makes productive remote work possible. Once the talent market is made universally accessible, those at the peak of their market thrive, while the rest suffer. In a seminal 1981 paper, the economist Sherwin Rosen worked out the mathematics behind these winner-take-all markets. Hearing a succession of mediocre singers does not add up to a single outstanding performance. In other words, talent is not a commodity you can buy in bulk and combine to reach the needed levels. There's a premium to being the best. Therefore, if you're in a marketplace where the consumer has access to all performers, the consumers will choose the very best, even if the talent advantage is small compared to the next rung down on the skill ladder. The superstars still win the bulk of the market. In the 1980s, when Rosen studied this effect, he focused on examples like movie stars and musicians, where there existed clear markets such as music stores and movie theaters, where a movie audience has access to different performers and can accurately approximate their talent before making a purchasing decision. The rapid rise of communication and collaboration technologies has transformed many formerly local markets into a similarly universal bazaar. The small company looking for a computer programmer or public relations consultant now has access to an international marketplace of talent, in the same way that the advent of the record store allowed the small town music fan to bypass local musicians to buy albums from the world's best bands. The superstar effect, in other words, has a broader application today than Rosen could have predicted 40 years ago. An increasing number of individuals in our economy are now competing with the rock stars of their sectors. I think that's a brilliant excerpt from Cal Newport's amazing book, Deep Work. Definitely go and get a copy. I cannot praise it highly enough. And the points he makes in it are so applicable, you know, to us in the editing world. I'll give you an example. Inside the Edit's designers live in Australia. Our graphics artist and online editor, they live in Spain. We've cherry-picked who we love to work with. You know, that idea, so long dreamt of, you know, of working from anywhere in the world on high-end projects, is finally a reality. You know, any Starbucks has Wi-Fi for a Zoom meeting with clients or to, you know, upload cuts to Vimeo or YouTube for feedback. I also think this is such a fascinating point to make, especially in the COVID and post-COVID world. You know, the lockdowns and changes to ours and every single industry will be over at some point, but it's created a kind of tectonic shift in the way clients see what we do as editors. Creativity itself has been redefined somewhat. Thousands of corporate clients, production companies, broadcasters, studios, online content creators, and millions of web-based companies are starting to realize that we, the editors, can be employed to cut from our homes, from our laptops on a park bench, or wherever, and still get the same high-end result. We are artists, and so that means that what you're employing us for is our mind, what's between our ears and not the software or the edit suite or us coming into an office for 8 to 10 hours a day. There's a great story I love about the artist Picasso. Towards the end of his life, when he was in his 70s, he moved down to the south of France. One day, he was sitting in a cafe doodling on a napkin. A woman approached him and said, "Oh, wow, Picasso, so wonderful to meet you. I'm a great fan." She noticed the drawings he'd done on his napkin and said, "Oh, can I buy one of these off you?" "Sure," Picasso said. "That'll be $10,000, please." "What?" said the woman. But it only took you a minute to draw. No, it didn't, Picasso politely informed the woman. It took me 50 years to draw. I love that story. But this story, though, as well as everything we've discussed on this topic today, goes to highlight a major fact. If we want to have that freedom, if we want a life that consists of that incredibly rare balance between independence, financial security, and creative nourishment, yes, all of these external factors that we've talked about, they really do help. But they only work if one other thing is present. Us bringing our A game to every single thing we cut. We have to have a fierce commitment to developing our craft and ourselves as artists. We have to not lose faith when we're not working on the prestigious projects we truly want to work on. Freedom is the ultimate goal, and the price of that freedom is dedication to our craft and making sure that every single thing that leaves our edit suite with our name on it is as good as it can be. I've done it, and I'm no more talented than you. You can do it as well. I hope you've enjoyed this week's creative discussion, dear friends. If that's the life you're interested in developing, I really do hope you get it. It's not easy to set up, and you know, it does take time, but it's also not impossible either. With drive and determination, anything is possible. Drop me an email if you have any thoughts on this subject or you'd like to discuss it further. I love hearing from all of you. I'm sure between us we have lots of really interesting and unique perspectives on this subject. So you can get hold of me by emailing podcast@insidetheedit.com. So it's time for this week's Q&A. And we've got a question from someone in my hometown of London for this week's show. Carola asks, have you had the chance to watch David Attenborough's new documentary? I find it amazing and had millions of questions pop into my head when watching it. One of them is, in this kind of documentary, you usually see random landscapes or climate events. Do they shoot everything themselves, or do they get this footage from somewhere else? Great question, Carola. I think the new doc you're talking about is David Attenborough, A Life on Our Planet, which has recently been released on Netflix. Unfortunately, I haven't caught it yet, but it is on my watching list for this weekend, funnily enough. I'm really looking forward to it. It looks absolutely sensational. But then, to be honest, every documentary David Attenborough is in, you know, does as well. The man is a living legend. At 94 years old, he's been making nature documentaries for almost as long as television has been around. He started work at the BBC the year my mother was born. So that should tell you something about how long he's been in the game. And he's the only person to win a BAFTA for films that he's made in, get this, black and white, colour, HD, 3D and 4K. This guy is old school and he's seen it all. In England, you know, we all grew up watching Attenborough films, and it was one of the great pleasures of actually staying up late to watch one because, you know, our parents were happy that we were watching something educational. The Natural History Unit, the world-famous department set up at the BBC in 1957 to make films about nature and wildlife and our planet in general, has truly been at the cutting edge of filmmaking techniques for well over half a century now. Every film that Attenborough has narrated or been involved in over the last few decades alone have been absolutely mind-blowing. You know, the Planet Earth series, the Blue Planet series, and many others, they've really pushed the boundaries of filmmaking technology to new heights. I mean, it's been absolutely astonishing to watch. And of course, from an editing perspective, every film is a masterclass in documentary cutting. I can't wait to watch this latest film. You know, he's reflecting on life in filmmaking and also on the state of our planet. So it should be absolutely fascinating. So your question, Carola, in films like these, we see random landscapes and climate events. Do they shoot everything themselves or do they take footage from somewhere else? Okay, so that all depends on a number of different factors, but let's just break them down. Nature cinematographers are a very niche type of cinematographer. You know, they sit in one place for weeks and months waiting to capture certain animals or insects or birds or whatever, you know, whatever they're looking for. I mean, some of the animals in the Planet Earth series, as far as I know, had never actually been caught on camera before in their natural habitat. And I remember hearing how long it took to get those images of the, I think it was the snow leopards. It was breathtaking. You know, these types of cinematographers have to be extremely patient, camping out in the middle of nowhere and just waiting. You know, that's a very specific type of cinematography artist right there. Of course, any film like that is also about the environment that the animals are in. And so a large amount of time is given to getting the shots of the landscape and the surrounding area and the beauty shots like, you know, sunrises and sunset and distinct foliage. Now, that's a different type of cinematography. And so they might use someone else who's an expert in that. Landscape shots, of course, don't take anywhere near the amount of time you need to capture the ongoing drama of an animal's life, you know, over a period of time. And, you know, all the amazing moments that it takes to get enough to make a film. Of course, nowadays as well, they have drone operators for aerial shots of the location and the action as well as a host of other weird and wonderful filming toys that are used to capture these beautiful images. But when you're talking about climate change images, that could be different. Now, and it all depends on time. And of course, time is all about budget. If there was a climate-based location, say an oil spillage somewhere, and the oil wasn't going to be cleared up for a long time, it would be easy to go and shoot that. On the other hand, climate-induced hurricanes, tornadoes, and other spontaneous weather conditions are unpredictable. And so camera operators usually go out and capture these difficult to predict conditions and shoot them on the fly. They then sell them to archive footage or news libraries to be bought later by other filmmakers. Another thing that can happen is that certain news organizations or indeed charities would fund that type of filming and use the images to promote the causes and to raise public awareness, because both these types of organizations have budgets. And there are many places on our Earth where you can actually see the effects of natural devastation, and you can go and film them. I was cutting a science documentary a few years back for, I think it was for Discovery or National Geographic, one of those ones, and some of which it was being filmed on the melting glaciers of Iceland. And it was really shocking to watch that raw footage. You know, deforestation in the Amazon or rivers sucked dry by over-farming, you know, that's there for all to see. But as always, it comes down to budget. So a production company probably wouldn't pay for a whole crew to go over to the Amazon rainforest to film the trees getting cut down if that only occupies, you know, half a scene or three or four shots at the start of their film. But if it's a whole film about deforestation, then they definitely would, and their whole budget would be spent on just that. Of course, it all depends as well on the production company or broadcaster. The BBC is a publicly funded broadcaster, so they got a pretty big budget, which is why so many of these series just look astonishingly good and take many years to film. hope I've answered your question, Carola, and I look forward to watching David Attenborough's A Life on Our Planet this weekend on Netflix. The trailer looks so good. We'll stick it on this week's episode page. If you have a creative question which you'd like answered on the show, do please send me an email and we will get it onto a future episode. You can reach me at podcast@insidetheedit.com. Of course, if you'd like to focus on and really learn this beautiful art form of ours, then come and join us at Inside the Edit. Thousands of members around the world have taken the industry's only professional level creative editing course. We turn you into a powerful creative editor. However, if you love self-directed learning but prefer the live experience, then the day has finally arrived. We've just opened up our registration page at insidetheedit.com for our brand new creative editing bootcamp. This truly is an evolution in the way our art form is going to be taught. We're going to pack an enormous amount of editing theory into a weekend and talk through dozens and dozens of clips and rough cuts and sync pools and cutting patterns and so much else. You know, we've designed this for creatives who love learning but like to do it in intense short bursts of creativity. Everything you learn in these weekends you can use immediately on your own projects. We're aiming to have our first event in November, and so go to the site now and register your interest with us. It's going to be a giant leap forward in creative edit training, and I am really excited about it. Okay, and finally, this week's competition to win an annual Creative Cloud license, courtesy of our good friends over at Adobe. With the exciting new launch of our bootcamp weekends, we want to ask you for this week's prize. What subjects do you want to see taught on the boot camps? Email your answer, why you've chosen that particular thing, and also where you are in the world, and you could be walking away with the prize on next week's show. I can't wait to hear what you come up with. As always, a big shout out goes to the wonderful team over at Universal Production Music for all of their beautiful music tracks. I had a great time picking them out this week, and if you think that any of them are perfect for what you're cutting right now, go over to the episode 16 page at podcast.insidetheedit.com, where we put the usual links in to all their tracks so you can go and license them for your current project. That about wraps it up for yet another episode of Once Upon a Timeline. I really do hope you've enjoyed it, dear friends. Please, please, please don't forget to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts if you like the show, and share and tag us on your social channels. We are a tiny company and we really appreciate you helping us in getting our name out there. Our community is growing, which is amazing. It's such an exciting time, and thank you so much for being an active part in it. Stay cool, stay safe, and stay cutting, my dear friends. I'll see you soon.